Have you ever wanted a super cool AI buddy? Zucks made one named Eileen. And she's full of surprises. And guess what? She knows you're listening.
I know you're out there.
And needs your help with Jell-O mountains.
The whole city's filling up with Jell-O.
Creaky robots.
Lime green detected.
And her daft inventor.
Zucks, are you functioning correctly?
Tune in to A to Z, a fun new adventure series from Gen Z Media and the creators of The Res. Listen now on the GZM app, gzmshows.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Earth Rangers podcast. I'm Earth Ranger Emma, coming to you live with the final episode of my very own Ultimate Guide to National Parks. Here we go! Hi, Earth Rangers. We're finally here. The final national park. Well, not the final national park in the world, or, well, even in North America. But definitely the final park and episode in my Ultimate Guide series. Which, as it so happens, is actually kind of two parks. Okay, I promise, I'm not cheating. It is technically all the same park. It just happens to span two different countries and happens to have different names on either side of the border. That's right. I currently find myself at the Waterton Glacier International Peace Park, which is called the Waterton Lakes National Park on the Alberta-Canada side and the Glacier National Park on the Montana-United States side, all joined together in 1932 for the purposes of conservation awesomeness. Also, this park doesn't just occupy two countries. Its waters flow into three different oceans, a very special ecological feature called a tri-ocean hydrographic divide, which is pretty impressive considering that both Alberta and Montana are landlocked. Not a coastline in sight for either. So, how then does the three ocean thing work? Well, simply said, all rivers lead to the ocean. Well, except for one super weird one called the Okavango in Botswana. Well, and the Volga and Ural rivers, which lead to the Caspian Sea. But, okay, except for those three, all other rivers do in fact lead to the ocean. And in the case of the waters that flow through Waterton Glacier Park, snow and rain that falls on the appropriately named Triple Divide Mountain Peak flow from the Columbia River watershed to the Pacific Ocean, the Mississippi River watershed to the Gulf of Mexico and on to the Atlantic Ocean, and from the Nelson River watershed to Hudson Bay and on to the Arctic Ocean, all depending on which part of the mountain a particular water droplet happens to fall on. It's actually pretty amazing when you think of it, just to realize how connected everything is. Actually, that's something I've been thinking about a lot lately. How connected all the animals and plants in a given ecosystem are, how connected the world's water and carbon systems are, and especially, how connected all of us human beings are. Since this is the last national park of my relaxation slash ultimate guide tour, on the way here to Waterton Glacier, I spent quite a bit of time reflecting on my experiences, both in terms of my own research practices and in how I share my adventures with all of you. And you know, I think there's actually a few things that I need to address to be a better researcher and a better Earth Ranger. You see, sometimes I take for granted how easy it is for me to hike and climb and navigate difficult terrain. Everybody deserves the chance to enjoy nature and explore. And many of us have different levels of ability or have someone in our lives that we care about who does. With this in mind, this time, I am going to pick a trail that is wheelchair and stroller friendly, so that I know when I recommend it, everyone can take part. Now, out of Waterton Glacier's trails, three of them fit the bill. First off, there's the Waterton Park Townsite Loop, which comes in at 43 minutes and features a spectacular view of Cameron Falls, and then wraps its way around the town of Waterton. Second in line, we have the Kootenai Brown Trail, which is a little bit more challenging coming in at 3 hours and 15 minutes, but it offers access to Waterton's sprawling wildflower fields. And finally, there's the Prince of Wales Loop. It's only 34 minutes long, has access to washrooms and benches, but also runs through the forest, along the Bosphorus Channel between Upper and Lower Waterton Lake, and ends atop a hill, allowing for a picture-perfect final view of even more fields of wildflowers. Well, when it's not winter. All of these trails seem like a fantastic way to spend an afternoon, but I think I'm leaning towards the Prince of Wales Loop. Enjoying nature doesn't have to mean pushing for the most extreme or most intense experiences, and I think ending on a leisurely note with a photo-worthy view is just the relaxing ending that my ultimate guide needs. Also, I think it's worth noting that it isn't just Waterton Glacier Park that offers accessible trails. Zion has the Powers Trail, Yosemite has the Happy Isles Loop, and the Everglades has Pahayoki Overlook, which even features Braille on their signage. All of these parks have accessibility centers with support staff ready to offer advice and guidance on how best to enjoy the parks. Finally, national parks in both the U.S. and Canada offer free admission to everyone living with a long-term disability and their caregivers. I mean, I have just barely scratched the surface of what's available. So if you want to know more, I'll be sure to include the links to both the U.S. and Canada's National Park Accessibility Info pages. Get out there and explore. And with that, I think it's time to head out on the trail. I'll catch up with you once I'm on my way. It's really beautiful here. Even though it's still winter and, as you might imagine, a little chilly, there's just something so special about being surrounded by mountains. It's a magical feeling. You know, they're so big and I'm so small. They're ancient and represent the movement of massive tectonic plates. Oh, those are plates that make up the surface of the Earth. It's the crust and the uppermost mantle that floats on top of a layer of molten rock. And right now, I have a front row seat, or, well, front row? Path? Stroll? I don't know, not important. I have the perfect view of Mount Cleveland, Mount Richardson, Mount Alderson, and Avian Ridge. They're all part of the Rocky Mountains, which were formed 150 million years ago, when the North American continental plate smashed into an oceanic plate. Now, I'm using the word smashed here very generously. More like, they pressed really hard into each other for about 75 million years, which is wild to think about. The movement that created the Rocky Mountains started 150 million years ago, but it only resulted in the mountains I'm looking at now 75 million years ago. Basically, the slowest motion smash in history. It's even more wild to think about how scientists discovered that that's how these mountains formed in the first place. They basically looked at the globe and started noticing patterns, high points and low points. They noticed that mountains form in ranges, big, long, consistent lines of craggy peaks. They noticed the way deep trenches opened up in the ocean floor along consistent lines as well. And they saw how earthquakes seemed to occur along, you guessed it, consistent boundaries, which they named fault lines. Finally, they realized that if you thought about these consistent boundaries as the edges of puzzle pieces, you could basically move the pieces back and eventually make a single mass of land, an ancient supercontinent called Pangaea. The dude who originally thought this up was a German meteorologist named Alfred Wegener. He started trying to convince people that tectonic plates were a thing back in 1912. Not many other scientists got on board, but by the 1960s, we had enough scientific tools and some serious research to prove that it was true. See? Good things take time. Both mountains and ideas with solid proof. On that point, I think I'll take my time too. I'm gonna make use of this handy dandy bench and sit for a while. Ah, that's better. Also, Time for a hot chocolate break, too. You know, it's pretty quiet here because it's winter, but there are still some birds doing their thing in February, believe it or not. Oh, you know what? I think I have a set of whistles in my bag. Let's see, spring calls, new summer calls, a little far off for that fall. Clown calls, no. Kazoo. Yes, here we go. Winter calls. I'm going to use this to say hi, and we'll see if any of the birds on my call keychain will say hi back. Okay, first one. Here's the call of a Barrow's Goldeneye. Kind of weird. I always remember this one by their oddly shaped oblong head. They look a little bit like if I tried to draw a duck with my left hand. Don't hear anything. Maybe they're a little shy? Or maybe they feel insulted that I called their head odd and oblong. Let's try another one. Okay, that was the call of a ruffed grouse. It's a non-migratory bird that can eat all sorts of poisonous plants that other birds simply can't stomach. It also thumps its wings to attract mates and can create cute little burrows in the snow to hide and camouflage. Do you hear anything? They might be hiding right now, and unwilling to say hello lest they reveal their position. Fair enough. Okay, let's try one last one. Ready? Oh, wow, did you hear that? Let's try again. Earth Rangers, that is none other than the headbanger of the natural world, the woodpecker. A hairy woodpecker, to be exact. These birds love high forest mountains, just like the ones I find myself in. And sometimes, in addition to tapping into bark to find tasty bugs, they'll also drink sap. I wonder what my bird whistle means in woodpecker. Like, am I saying, hey you, or hello, or is it more along the lines of what's up, fam? I suppose we'll never really know. Actually, that brings me to an important thought. Let me just tidy up and get on the trail again. I'll check back in with you when I'm closer to Upper Waterton Lake, the deepest lake in Alberta. Okay. I'm back, and I am going to get into the research stuff that I've been talking about. But first, I mean, I know we're all thinking it, but I just have to say it. Frozen lakes are one of the most fascinating ecosystems of all time. Right now, I'm looking out over a wide expanse of ice, and everything looks perfectly still. But under the surface of that ice, there's tons of life. A ton of fish and turtles and frogs that are sleeping the absolute deepest of sleeps in something called suspension. Suspension is almost the same thing as hibernation. And water animals that don't migrate do this by slowing down their metabolisms to the point where they are using the absolute bare minimum amount of energy. Mammals do this too, but what's really interesting about aquatic and amphibious animals is that they need to be able to almost completely freeze their bodies without getting hurt, and also reduce the amount of oxygen they need to survive. Just think about that. Down there, right now, is a bunch of northern pike or deepwater sculpin that are sleeping so deeply, they're barely breathing. Now, it's not just an adaptation thing. They also have the help of water pressure to make sure that they don't get too cold. Now, you might know that heat tends to travel up and cold tends to travel down, right? It's why attics are stuffy and basements tend to be more chilly. But freezing cold bodies of water are the exception to this rule. The top layer freezes and becomes ice, but the bottom layers stay liquid because A, they're protected from the cold by the surface ice, and B, all of the water in the top layers pushes down on the bottom layers, preventing it from forming the crystal pattern that water needs to form to become solid. It's wild. It seems to break all the rules. And we know about it because of the work of so many brilliant scientists. See? Told you I'd get back to the research thing. You see, in addition to thinking about the different ways that people interact physically with nature, I've also been spending a lot of time thinking about different ways of understanding nature. Yes, of course it's important to take time to appreciate its beauty, or to breathe in and notice how being in nature makes you feel. But there is also more scientific, systematic ways that we can look at nature in order to better understand it. Okay, so remember how during my jaunt in the Everglades, I took a moment to photograph and label the different ecosystems that I was looking at? Well, that's a form of ecological research. It's not super in-depth or anything, which, in my defense, I was moving at 35 miles per hour, which is about 30 knots or 30 nautical miles, which are longer for some reason than land miles. That's not the point. The point is, taking those pictures is a form of field research, or what's called documentation. This can be a short-term thing, like taking a picture, or a much longer-term thing, like taking many pictures over time to notice changes. But personal observation, like taking pictures or making notes, isn't the only form of research. Scientists can also use other methods like remote sensing, which, I know, sounds vaguely psychic, but it's not. It's just when you use technology to collect info from afar. Think satellites and pictures taken from the sky in airplanes. Researchers can also create something called models, which are like pictures or systems, using the info that they've collected to try and figure out things that they can't see firsthand. Remember that fur trap I accidentally bumped into in Grossmorn? Well, scientists use those to estimate how many creatures are in an area by adding up the number of fur samples they collect in a week. They can also test the DNA of the fur to learn more about the genetic makeup of the animal they're studying. All of these research methods offer something very different, but what they all have in common is that they're about answering questions. And that's what science is really about. Looking at the world around you, getting really curious and saying, I wonder why that is the way it is. Or I wonder how that thing affects this thing. Or I wonder how big this is, or how old that is, or when this started being like that, and how. I think what I've realized through all of my national parks adventures is that the question part is every bit as important as the research part. And heading into this next year, I want to start asking way more questions. And I would love for you to help me. You know, let me know if there's any animal or ecological mysteries that you'd like help solving, and add them to the comments page on the app. I mean, personally, I have a few questions that have been itching my brain for a while. Things like, you know, do centipedes really have 100 legs? And why? And do millipedes have more? And how come worms don't have any? I am ready to go toe-to-toe with some creepy crawlers, design a leg-counting experiment, and figure out the answers once and for all. And it would be so cool if you sent in your own burning questions. I'll figure out a research plan, answer them, and we'll use the power of science to learn more about the natural world. I think it's going to be a pretty awesome new chapter for the podcast. You know, I think number one was right. I think maybe a little rest and relaxation really is necessary to refresh and come up with new ideas. So, on that note, I'm going to head up to the top of the hill to get that final lookout snapshot, and you get to work sending in your research proposals. And with that, my ultimate guide to national parks comes to an end. Well, for now. I know there are still a ton of exciting parks that I didn't get a chance to visit this time around, so I reserve the right for a part two in the future. I really hope you got inspired to maybe visit one of the parks I introduced you to if you get the chance. And if you do, tell us all about it in the comments. Until then, thanks for listening, stay curious, and keep on ranging. Bye! Earth Rangers! Earth Rangers!
Earth Rangers! Hello, parents, homeschoolers, and teachers. Trusty Narrator here from the Who Smarted podcast. Our 15-minute episodes are perfect for car rides, bedtime, break time, class time, or any time. We make learning science and history fun and funny for 7 to 11-year-olds with new episodes every week. Look for Who Smarted on any podcast platform or at whosmarted.com. And teachers get a free subscription to our ad-free version by clicking educators at whosmarted.com.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jeremy.
I'm Autumn.
And I'm Jasper.
And we're a GZM family. And we want you to listen to our favorite show, Becoming Mother Nature.
I love the one with the Grim Reaper and the zombies.
Do you want to hear your family at the end of a show giving a shout-out? Go to gzmshows.com/shoutout to learn more. That's gzmshows.com/shoutout for a chance to be heard on this show.